Honorable Justices, may it please the Court. My name is Robert Stewart, and I represent...
Sometimes we wish we were justices, but those are the people who overrule us. We're just judges. Okay.
Honorable Judge.
Commonly known, there's no justice in the Ninth Circuit.
Well, hopefully there will be today. I'm the attorney for Evergreen International Airlines, one of the appellants in this matter. I was asked to propose a split of the time allocation with co-appellant Alaska Central Express, and I would intend to take 10 minutes, argue at this point for 8, reserving 2 for rebuttal.
Okay, we'll try to help you keep
track. In the time that I have, what I'd like to do is highlight a few key factual issues and focus on 2 of what I feel are the 4 central legal issues that are presented in this appeal, and those are the trial court's failure to consider the evidentiary materials submitted by Evergreen and by Alaska Central, and the question of the retroactive disqualification of Evergreen from eligibility to carry bypass mail in the bypass mail system. As to the other 2 central issues, the irrationality of this absolute barrier to entry represented by the 75% passenger carry requirement and the improper delegation of control over entry into the market to competitors, and in this case principally Alaska Airlines, I'll rely upon the briefing unless the Court has questions. First thing I'd like to do is set a little context, if I can, and talk about the standard of review. We acknowledge and we do not argue with the legal standard of review. It's a daunting one. We need to show that there was no rational relationship between the classifications in the statute and any legitimate government purpose. We also acknowledge that when you look at the Supreme Court cases, the Ninth Circuit cases, it is a rare case where this type of challenge prevails. But at the same time, and apropos to justice being done here today, we want to focus the Court on the discussion that you find in cases like Matthew v. Locus, which reminds the Court that this cannot be a mere toothless review. It cannot be a mere rubber stamp of the governmental action. And so what we submit is this is one of these cases where the abuses are so extreme that if there's going to be any meaningful judicial review, this is the type of the case where the Court ought to intervene.
The abuses revolve around whether there's a legitimate government interest for these restrictions?
It revolves both around whether it's a legitimate government interest, and it also revolves around whether there's an appropriate nexus between whatever governmental purpose there is out there and the means that were chosen.
Why don't you elucidate those? Because we know the facts and read your briefs. I'm interested in your theory on how you base your assertion that there was a problem here.
Well, I think, and I'll go to that, but I think the linchpin is the evidentiary ruling of the trial court. And if this court determines that there was no error by the trial court in ignoring the affidavit of Faint Myers and ignoring the affidavit of Jerry Rock, then the evidence there that shows the irrationality, and you go back to Armendariz and Lockery, and they say a plaintiff challenging constitutionality has a right to put in evidence, has a right to show that the purpose simply doesn't exist, as in Lockery, that there was no water shortage. And so when you turn to the affidavit of Hank Myers and you look at the postulated purpose here, one of stability, that affidavit debunks that myth. And the affidavit of Myers says there simply was no instability in the bypass mail system in Alaska at the time of the enactment of the statute. The carriers that were in there at the time, 4 of them, 5 of them actually, and that's one of the issues we have here, were growing. There was no evidence of underabsorbed capacity. There was no evidence of losses. There was no flux since 1995 when Linden was grandfathered into the marketplace in terms of the number of carriers. So we have the shibboleth out there of stability. And it's worth noting at the same time that stability is nowhere found in the terms of the statute. It's something the United States made up and the trial court decided to adopt because it's a little more consistent with the circularity of the logic implied in terms of the means-ends nexus that, well, it was rational for Congress to decide that it wanted four carriers. Circular logic. And so, guess what it did? It passed a statute that bumped one, Evergreen International, and left four in the marketplace. Well, of course, if you assume the result, which is what that logic does, then of course you'll find rationality. But if you look at Delaware River Basin, Third Circuit cautions highly against circularity of logic of that type.
Well, I'm a little lost here. Help me. You're saying that the judge disregarded those affidavits, but I've just checked my memory here. The judge ruled on a motion to dismiss. Then you're saying his error was going to a motion to dismiss rather than treating it as a motion for summary judgment.
Yes, yeah. And here's how I think.
Wait a minute. Is that what you're arguing?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, what's our standard of review on that?
Okay.
On the judge's decision to go with treating it as a motion to dismiss.
I think it's a question of law, Your Honor. And here's the logic, if I might. Okay. I'm a civil lawyer, and this is sort of Alice in Wonderland stuff to me. Okay, I come into this case, and the first thing I do, like any other case, is I want to know, what's my evidence? What do I have to prove? How do I make my case? And I go read the cases, and I find, well, there's this amazing thing out there. The United States, the government, gets to have these things called legislative facts. Are they evidence? No. They can make them up.
No, but and this may be Alice in Wonderland, but it's getting more Alice in Wonderland for me, because is it possible for, in this case, a motion for judgment on the pleadings to be filed? And they did. And is it possible for the judge then to rule on that? And he did. Now, what's the problem with it? What's the legal error there?
Okay, the legal error is he brought in extra record material. He brought in the legislative facts. And here's the logic. Okay. They can bring these pieces of evidence in, and they did. They argued stability. You find stability nowhere in the statute. There was no legislative history because there were no hearings conducted. There was only cursory remarks by Senator Stevens at the enactment. So the United States, where the statute reads safe, affordable, reliable, non-mail freight and passenger service, they come in with this thing, stability. And constitutional jurisprudence says they can do it. They can make these things up. But when you bring extrinsic legislative facts like that, when you bring an extrinsic legislative fact like this nexus between keeping four and four only and stability, you are de facto converting that motion to dismiss to a Rule 56 proceeding. And if you go look at Minnesota v. Cloverleaf Creamery, it is really clear that plaintiffs such as Evergreen have to be permitted to challenge the rationality of those facts. As in Lockery, we have to be permitted to show that this assumed purpose, a need for stability, simply doesn't exist because the facts are such, and here once again, this Alice in Wonderland litigation, I don't have to prove by preponderance. I have to prove that it's not even fairly debatable. I have to prove that no reasonable legislator could reasonably have conceived that such a state of affairs existed. And so I go out and do it. I get Hank Myers, a recognized expert in this area, who's advised the Postal Service, and he analyzes this and says, there's simply no problem with instability. There is no rationality in the purported purpose because the problem doesn't exist, just like the water shortage, just like the housing situation in Armendariz. And when I show that the purported problem doesn't exist, the legislative purpose is not rational. When I go on and then I show that the nexus between the classification and even assuming stability is the issue is not rational. When I go on and show that the 75% passenger carry requirement is an absolute barrier, not something that will foster passenger carry, not something that will foster mail carriage, but it's an absolute barrier to entry. I have proven it's irrational. And that's the real error in what Judge Singleton did, because he ignored that. And I see I'm probably a little over my time. I want to drop a footnote here, which is important. Judge Singleton not only ignored the evidence, but then he compounded that error by getting into the very factual areas. And if you go read his opinion, he talks about whether there's a barrier of entry, and he says it's high. Not insurmountable, but high. Where's the evidence? The United States didn't put it in. It's not in the legislative record. He made a finding on that factual subject area that is inconsistent with the only uncontroverted evidence in the record. He then goes on, again, similarly, in the delegation issue, and he says, those folks, Alaska Airlines et al., will not act irrationally. They will not engage in behavior consciously, intentionally to bar entry. Again, where's the evidence? Not in the legislative record, not in anything the United States provided him. The uncontroverted evidence from Mr. Meyer's affidavit is that they will, and that it will be cost-effective for them in the long run. So I'll add to that that there, in fact, is a 12B issue here, because while he didn't specifically consider an affidavit the United States put in, he went and considered the factual areas that were touched upon in our submittals, and he made factual findings which are unsupported entirely by the record, and he refused to acknowledge the evidence that was put in front of him. I have 15 seconds that I'll reserve if I might. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Michael Berger for Appellant Alaska Central Express. And since we have some divergence on our positions factually, I'd like to reserve 1 minute of my time.
We'll try to help you, but keep track.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to go a little bit into this whole question of what's our burden and how does this Court review legislation that Congress enacts for constitutionality, because I think that there's an important fact here that isn't out on the table this morning, and that is this is not ordinary legislation. This legislation did not go through the traditional congressional vetting machinery that is what gives rise to the normal presumptions that this Court makes in terms of the validity and rationality and constitutionality of what Congress does. Normally, somebody introduces a bill, it's assigned to committees in both houses eventually, it has hearings, it's subject to legislative investigations, there are witnesses, there is public testimony. None of that occurred in this case. This bill was cooked up and attached as a rider at the 11th hour in a House Senate conference committee that was considering the appropriations bill for the Homeland Security Department immediately after the 9/11 attacks.
Admitting that's correct, so what? I mean, what are we supposed to take from that?
I think, Your Honor, what you need to take from that is that at some point in the governmental process, there needs to be some scrutiny of what this statute is. Normally, that would occur in the legislative process, and this Court would rightly defer to things that Congress might have thought they were doing when they enacted a piece of legislation. I would submit to you that in a case like this, where there was deliberate evasion of the normal congressional process, neither Judge Singleton nor this Court ought to be in the position of saying, well, this is what Congress was trying to do. We haven't a clue what Congress was trying to do. All we have is the statement on the floor of the senator who sponsored this piece of legislation. We have one complaint by a congressman who caught wind of what was happening, Congressman Cunningham, and said on the floor, this is a travesty. This is one senator trying to put a company out of business, and you're tying that kind of legislation onto an emergency appropriation piece of legislation, and we shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't be in the business of enacting legislation to drive a competitor of the senator's friends out of business. Because I want you to remember when this happened, that at that time there were five airlines that were carrying bypass mail and had been for years. This legislation put one of those five, Alaska Central Express, out of business. Alaska Central had been carrying this same kind of mail under contract with the Postal Service since 1990. Okay? I totally sympathize with what Evergreen was going through, but they got into this 2 weeks before this statute was enacted, after the statute had gone through all this process, so that at that time, as Congressman Cunningham put it, this statute was designed to get rid of one competitor. The way that they did that was to enter into definitional games. And I think that some court has got to look at the definitional game that they played. They set this thing up and said there are going to be three requirements for carrying bypass mail in the Alaska system. And one of those is that you have to be a Part 121 certified carrier. Okay, my clients have said under oath in this litigation that if they knew that was a requirement, they would have gone out and done it, even though it would take them a year, cost them $1 million or so to do. This is a lucrative business for them. They've almost shut out of business entirely because of this statute. But what did Congress do with that, or what did the senator do with it that he swept through Congress? He said, we're going to say you must be 121 certified as of a year and a half ago. Now, if he had said as of a year and a half from now, that's fair. We're at least on notice. If we have to do that, we've got time to comply. We've been in this business for a dozen years, carrying the mail without complaint by anybody. And now he tells us that as of a year and a half ago, we had to go time travel and comply with a requirement that has never been a requirement. Something about this process, Your Honor, stinks, to use a legal term. And I think that someplace, whether it be in Congress or in court, somebody has to take a look at this. That's all that we're asking for here, is that the look that we never got in Congress is something that we should have gotten in court. Both sides here, both part appellants, submitted affidavits below that explained what was going on. We tried to get discovery from the federal government about what was behind this legislation. Judge Singleton refused. The feds sought protective orders. He granted the protective orders. Now, to me, making it worse, at the same time that he granted their protective orders and denied us discovery, he invited us to file Brandeis briefs with him to bring in all sorts of extra record stuff so that we could explain to him what the problems were with this legislation. And then what did he do? He wrote an opinion that said, well, based on the pleadings, I don't see a problem. Your Honor, at some point, somebody's got to look at this thing. This stuff makes no sense. It isn't just a bad law. It is an unconstitutional law. It has no basis. There is no backup for it. As what it's got,
there's no legitimate governmental interest.
There is no legitimate governmental interest. The only thing that Judge Singleton could point to is two things. One was the findings that were made in the statute. And two was the senator's expressions on the floor when he explained this addition to the Homeland Security Appropriations Bill. Now, as the U.S. Supreme Court put it in Lucas versus Southern California Coastal Council, findings of that nature are worthless as evidence. What they mean is that somebody's got a bright staff guy who wrote findings. And the same thing goes for statements that senators make on the floor of the Senate. As the court put it in Lucas, any legislative body that can't come up with findings that'll support its legislation has simply got a stupid staff. Not my words, the Supreme Court's words. And that's the only evidence that Judge Singleton had here. There isn't anything else. The evidence shows that we presented to them. I mean, all you need to do is look at this bill. What is there about this legislation that will increase passenger service? Nothing. The four airlines that were left and grandfathered in to carry this kind of mail, only one of them carries passengers at all. The other three don't. There is nothing in this legislation that gives those three any incentive to carry passengers. There's nothing in this legislation that penalizes them for not carrying passengers. And as Mr. Stewart told you, there is an absolutely impenetrable barrier to new airlines coming in who will carry passengers. That was a pretext. It was designed simply to protect these four carriers and drive anybody else either out of the market or keep them from coming into the market. The pretextual nature of this statute has got to be examined somewhere. Decreased expense. That's another thing they said they were trying to accomplish. There's nothing in this statute that will decrease the expense. Why do I say that? Because the evidence that we submitted to Judge Singleton shows that the way that the government determines how much they're going to pay for this bypass mail delivery is based on the expenses of those four airlines. Well, their expenses aren't going down, and the evidence also shows that one of those four has higher expenses than my client did. You average us in, you're going to drop the expenses. You knock them out, you're going to drop the expenses.
Okay, I think we've got your argument in hand. There's not very much time left, so why don't we save it for both of you to have for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Louis Yellen, here today from the Department of Justice for the United States. With me at council table is Scott Craigie. He's counsel for the intervener appellees. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for Mr. Craigie.
Okay. We'll try to help you, but
I'll keep an eye on my time. Yes, Your Honor. I really have one point that I'd like to make, Your Honor, and that's just that the claim about whether the district court improperly failed to consider evidence. This court does have a line of cases that allows, in a particular context, plaintiffs to submit evidence to show that a claimed rational basis is a pretext for arbitrary action. This is the Lockery and the Armendariz case that Evergreen cites. That context is when there are regulatory enforcement actions brought by an executive agent. Lockery concerned a utility refusing to provide water hookups. Armendariz concerned overzealous housing code. And as this court's most recent case on this issue, Squaw Valley, makes very clear, this context is only in this very particular area where you have regulatory officials enforcing a regulation. This line of cases has never been applied in an evaluation of the rationality of a statute.
Isn't rationality a factual question, however? I understand it's a very lenient test, strongly favoring the government. But the test is, did Congress have a permissible purpose?
That's right.
Isn't that a factual question?
It is a factual question, but it's one
and
that...
And how can we then decide it on the pleadings if there's something underlying there that we need to determine as a factual matter?
Because the factual showing is so minimal that all the court needs to be able to decide is that it is conceivable that the means that Congress selected are rationally related to the end that Congress chose to pursue. And that is so minimal a showing that the clear precedent of the Supreme Court in Beach Communications, in this court, in Dittman, say all the court needs to do is consider whether or not it's conceivable that the ends that Congress selected...
But shouldn't the plaintiffs have had an opportunity to introduce evidence to show that on the facts of this case it is inconceivable?
No,
and
Your
fact,
Honor...
Their argument is, whether they're right or not on the facts, I don't say their argument is all of the purposes that they had. This clearly came from purposes. This didn't happen by accident.
Right.
But their argument is that all the purposes that were there were impermissible, and on the facts, as they see them, it is inconceivable that Congress had a permissible purpose. Shouldn't they be allowed factual proof on that question?
No, Your Honor, because I would submit that claim is plainly wrong. We showed conceivable rational connections.
And how did you show that?
By point, we gave an explanation, for example, for the 75% passenger carry.
That is to say, you provided facts.
We gave an explanation that just from a general knowledge that a court may have shows a connection between the ends that Congress chose
and
to pursue.
What's the general knowledge that a court may have that you relied on?
In the case of a 75% passenger requirement, shall I use that example since that's one of the most contested?
Sure. Let's do that.
The concern that Congress had, among other things, one of the purposes that Congress chose to pursue here was to ensure reliable passenger service. The as we've explained in the brief, there's a limited pool of money that Congress has, and it's, I'd like to emphasize, this is spending clause legislation. Congress wanted to spend its money to support reliable passenger service. It's concerned that the market is sufficiently unstable that if there were too many people, too many entities receiving the funds that Congress chose to spend, this would undermine the stability of the service.
That sounds like a factual proposition.
That is exactly right.
And
it is a factual.
Be allowed to come in with evidence and say, that is preposterous. That is a bald-faced lie. Anybody who sees the facts as they exist has to recognize that it is inconceivable that Congress actually had that purpose.
That's precisely their argument, but the purposes...
And they can't produce any evidence to support that?
No, they can't, Your Honor.
Oh, my goodness.
The purposes are absolutely clear from the statute, and the means are absolutely clearly related to the purposes of the statute. The 75% passenger requirement, for example, Congress was concerned that if another carrier came in, imagine if the new carrier came in and bumped out through competition, bumped out the original carrier. Congress wanted to make sure that there would be at least 75% capacity in the new carrier so that Alaskans wouldn't lose a dramatic number of passenger seats, or alternatively, that the market was strong enough to support two carriers.
Well, that may be true. That may be exactly what Congress had in mind, or it may be conceivable that Congress had that in mind. They say it's not. And at least as I hear them, they say we were not allowed to produce any evidence to try to persuade the judge that our position was right.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly consistent with this Court's governing precedent and the governing precedent of the Supreme Court. Beach Communication says that...
So you get to introduce facts and they don't. That's what I hear.
Legislative facts. Facts that Congress identified. Your Honor, there's no two ways about it. The standard is amazingly sympathetic to the government purposes.
What was legislative fact that about the Part 121 backdate? It had to be a Part 121 carrier a year and a half earlier than...
Well, Congress was concerned about promoting safety, and Part 121 has more stringent carrier requirements than the Part 135. So the Part 121 is directly related to one of the purposes, namely the safety of the air travel that's available. If Your Honor's concerned about what the appellants are calling the retroactivity, is that one of the concerns that Your Honor had?
Well, it's an interesting question. But of course, the more basic question is whether we have any jurisdiction to start mind reading on legislative performance. One thinks of some of the recent legislation that comes pouring out of Washington, and a lot of it is entirely imaginary or whimsical, or the reasons for the legislation. Some of it is mischievous on its face, but that's none of our business. I think separation of powers leaves us with a very limited amount of leverage on scrutinizing the behavior of Congress.
I think that's exactly right. In this particular field, the field of economic regulation, especially...
It doesn't mean we approve of it. It's just we don't have anything to say about it.
That's exactly right. The court can think that Congress was flat wrong in the choice that it made. But as long as, and this is from Beach Communication, as long as the plaintiff doesn't negative every conceivable basis which might support the statute, every conceivable basis that might support the statute...
I understand that. That makes perfect sense to me. What I'm having trouble with is that these plaintiffs say, we have evidence that will convince the judge, if he's willing to look at it, that we by which we can negative every conceivable basis. And the judge says, well, I'm sorry, I'm not going to look at your evidence.
But that's, Your Honor, that's just the way rational review of economic legislation works. You cannot try, I mean, again, from...
But if that's right, no plaintiff can ever introduce any evidence in a rational basis question.
That as long as a conceivable basis is apparent, that's exactly right. Again, Your Honor, from Beach Communication...
Well, apparent is different from true. They're arguing it's simply not true. And as soon as you understand the facts, they say it is inconceivable that Congress had that purpose.
I just don't think that presenting evidence can produce the... Since the question is whether it is conceivable, not whether Congress actually had one purpose or another, it doesn't matter whether or not plaintiffs have evidence that they could introduce to show that Congress did not, in fact, have this particular...
This is kind of a metaphysical question. What do we mean by congressional purpose? What if they're able to say, and I'm totally making this up now,
yes,
this hypothesis, this is not a factual statement. What if they show that every person in Congress who actively moved this legislation forward was doing so because they had been paid off to do so? I'm not saying that that's the case.
Of course.
I'm saying, what if they can show that every person who had an active part in this legislation was being paid illegitimately to do it, being bribed? Is that enough to delegitimate the statute?
I think not, Your Honor, because in a separation of powers principles which underlie this sort of rational basis review.
So it's possible that the people who voted for it, who had no connection with it and no knowledge of it, if they thought about it, could have had a conceivable purpose. It doesn't matter that everybody who was involved was bribed.
That's right, Your Honor, because the point here is this is a question, the rational basis review test is set on separation of powers principles. That would be obviously deplorable if that was the way Congress arrived at certain legislation. But the point of rational basis review is those sorts of problems are meant to be remedied by political solutions, not by judicial solutions. I mean, in Beach Communications, if I can, the Supreme Court said a legislative choice is not subject to courtroom fact-finding and may be based on rational speculation unsupported by evidence or empirical data. It's just not the sort of thing that is amenable to the presentation of evidence, as long as there's a conceivable basis which can justify the classifications that Congress chose to use.
If we follow that, then is it your conclusion that if we go down the road the appellants want and allow the fact finding to come in, then we would be legislating, in effect, because we would now change the legislation to allow differences relative to 121, differences to load carry and whatever, so that we could legislate on the bench who gets in. Is that the point?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. It's exactly the sort of detailed nitpicking concerns that appellants are presenting that are subject to legislative policy decision-making,
well,
not to judicial fact-finding.
And the ugly underbelly of the Congress is something they're going to have to deal with in Congress politically. Or if there was a crime committed, somebody ought to indict somebody.
Precisely right, Your Honor.
Is that your point?
That's precisely right, Your Honor. And it's clear from this litigation that appellants did have a representative in Congress that voiced objection to the legislation. Nevertheless, both houses of Congress passed this legislation. It was signed by the President. That's all the Constitution requires. It's to make valid legislation.
Going back to the motion to dismiss, the judge recites verbatim the findings of Congress. So if we find any rational basis in those findings, which he used, if we go beyond that, then we're going to conduct the fact-finding that Congress is alleged should have happened, whether or not it did happen. Is that it? In other words, if we take the findings that the judge elucidated as being the reason for the legislation, the rational basis, okay? And if we decide, well, there was no fact-finding, we're going to do the fact-finding on those, then we're substituting ourselves for what Congress did or didn't do on the legislative side.
I think that's
is
correct,
that,
Your Honor.
Is that what you're saying?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Whether it's true or not, as long as you pass that rational test.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. We don't have to like the legislation. We could think that it was misguided, that it was unwise, that it was unfair, but as long as Congress selected legitimate ends, and I think it's very hard to dispute that providing reliable, safe, and affordable passenger and freight service is anything but a legitimate government
end. Well, exclusionary legislation is always unfair. I mean, somebody's going to get hurt here, hurt bad.
Exactly right. Again, in Beach Communication, the Supreme Court said, look, there are any time that the Congress chooses to make a line-drawing determination, there are going to be some who are favorably treated and some who are unfavorably treated. That line-drawing, the Court said, and I'm quoting, is virtually unreviewable. Virtually unreviewable, precisely because it returns on all of these particular facts that Congress can legitimately consider.
Well, there's a bill of attainder claim here.
There is a bill of attainder claim. I'm happy to address any question the court
has.
Well,
that's one way to address your argument.
Well, if Congress actually enacts a bill of attainder, that is a problem. That's exactly right, Your Honor. But I think our brief demonstrates that is very far from the case here. I'm happy to go through the argument if that would be helpful to the court, but I'm also happy to.
No, I've read that. I was just making a comment that if this was a bill of attainder, that's one way to address the horribles of this.
That's exactly right. That's an outside stop on Congress's ability to enact otherwise largely discretionary legislation. That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Can I get at your definition of conceivable? to take an outer boundary sort of example,
sure,
not related to this case, is it conceivable that space aliens are visiting this planet in invisible and undetectable craft?
Is it conceivable?
That's my question.
Yes, it's conceivable.
And that would be a basis for sustaining congressional legislation if Congress did, if the person sponsoring the bill said, space aliens are visiting us in invisible and undetectable craft, and that's the basis for my legislation, we can't touch it?
If Congress made a finding of that sort...
That's my question.
Your Honor, I think if Congress made a finding of that sort, I think, Your Honor, it would not be appropriate for this Court to second-guess that.
Okay. In other words, conceivable is any piece of nonsense is enough.
Your Honor, I don't think it is largely unbounded. It is not completely unbounded.
How can you say it's not completely unbounded when you agreed with my absolutely preposterous example of what's conceivable?
Because there are certain cases, Your Honor, where Congress makes specific findings that are directly at odds with the ends that Congress selected. And those very few cases where the Supreme Court has said there is a mismatch between between means and ends, because Congress said, or oftentimes it's a state legislature, the legislature said it was going to do X, but it adopted means that on their face obviously do not X. In that sort of a context, the courts can say there's a mismatch. We are so far from that here, Your Honor, and we're also so far from the space aliens example that I think that this is just...
Could I ask you about another thing? This is not from outer space. This is from the trial judge's... opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Order. He says the legislative facts that the government uses in support of its motion are not beyond the scope of materials to be considered on a motion to dismiss. And I guess there's some authority for that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he goes on to say, and their authenticity is not questioned. Now, I understand from the argument that was made by Mr. Stewart that the authenticity of these facts was questioned. So what does this mean?
I have to confess, Your Honor, I'm not sure what the court meant, district court meant by the authenticity of the facts. I mean, they're not...
He says it's not questioned. It sounds like the language one would use in a summary judgment motion saying there's no material question of fact.
I would have thought that it might be an evidentiary standard, that there's not a concern with, like, you know,
well, anyway,
getting...
Anyway, it's an interesting concept of it.
Right, but I guess the concise response I would have to Your Honor's observation is that it is just so well settled that congressional findings in a piece of legislation are sufficient, but not necessary basis.
In other words, whatever they are, they're bulletproof in court.
That's right, Your Honor, unless there's an explicit mismatch between means and ends, which we don't have here.
Well, also, aren't we, these findings of fact are pretty tightly wound around the specificities of the carriers and what's happening, so there's no question about who's a 121 or who's got 75%. Nobody's arguing about the facts. It's that somebody got clipped because they fell in between the interpretation of how they wanted to apply those facts when they did the legislation. If you're at 121, you're in. If you're not, you're not in, and that sort of thing. So I don't think anybody's arguing about who falls into what category or that there's a disputed issue of fact there. It's how you cut the line. And so if we go into fact-finding, we say, we don't like the line.
That's exactly
right.
And it
seems to me that we have to question then whether the line is all right relative to the governmental purpose and to the law.
That's exactly right.
Because once the line comes down, it's ball game over.
That's precisely our point. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we've detained you a little into your co-counsel's time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, we're in outer space now.
Yeah, but the space aliens are responsible.
May it please the Court. I'm Scott Craigie. I represent the intervener defendants, three of the mainline carriers, about which much has been said. I'd like to just offer a few comments to perhaps bring the argument back down to earth. First, rational relationship is not an evidentiary test. It's a logical examination that the court does go through and should go through, but it is not based on a scintilla of evidence or substantial evidence or proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't get into that. Rational relation.
Excuse me. I didn't mean to interrupt you. That's what I was trying to get at. When the judge listed exactly what Congress found, then you used the rational test on that, not a fact-finding test.
Right. And that's only – that finding is just one of the issues. That's the purpose. Then is there a rational connection between the means chosen and that purpose? And I think – so I don't think we get into the evidence. I don't think we need to. And indeed, if the plaintiff were correct, you could not have a motion to dismiss in a due process case. We know that is not the case, and it would be bad law if it was. This case is also easier than the discussion thus far has suggested, because the purpose as set forth in the findings was not to increase passenger service and freight service. But if you read it carefully, this was an amendment to a long-existing program. And Section 3002B12 of the findings says that it was to ensure that Alaskans continue to have affordable, reliable, and safe passenger service. So you don't have to prove that the means chosen will promote additional. Congress was concerned that the system has been set up and run pretty effectively. Not perfect, but it has served Alaskans well. Wanted to make sure that that system is not unduly threatened and that there is not a risk of instability. The government doesn't have to prove that there was instability. We rely on the logic that if you start out from the proposition that we can agree on several things. One, Congress may properly use mail revenues to promote non-mail services. Second, that an increase in the number of carriers dilutes the number of dollars going to each. Third, at some point, dilution will be so great that the amount of mail revenues going to any particular carrier will no longer be sufficient to, as Senator Stevens said, underwrite the non-mail services. And fourth, I think we can all agree that Congress may limit the number of carriers to avoid undue dilution. Okay. If we agree on all that, the only question is how many and what criteria are used to select. None of those are factual issues.
You're over, and I think we understand well that argument.
Thank you very much.
Now you've each saved a little, but not much. Why don't we start out with a minute each? And
let me get to what I think is the heart of the matter with the questions about fact-finding, because I think that's important. And we are not suggesting that you get into a full-blown trial with preponderance of the evidence, and we are not suggesting that the trial court becomes a secondary legislature. But the law is clear. When you go look at Minnesota versus Cloverleaf Creamery, parties may introduce evidence. What's the test? We, the plaintiffs, have to convince the court that the legislative facts on which the classification is apparently based, or in this case, hypothetically based, could not reasonably be conceived to be true. So we put in the evidence. It's not that we would like to. We submitted it. It was never excluded. It's in the record. And the trial court simply ignored it. Once we do that, we don't get into a full-blown evidentiary hearing. We don't get into full-blown fact-finding. As a matter of fact, yet again, we have this third imbalance in favor of the government. All the government has to do is come back and say, they're wrong. Here's some evidence, and it is fairly debatable.
Okay, you're outside your minute, and we understand the argument.
Sure. Thanks.
Let me follow up on that for just a moment, if I might, on the question of fact-finding and who's doing what to whom. We're not asking that this court or the district court take over the congressional role of fact-finding. But I do want to bring this court back to the Supreme Court's comment in Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Council that the congressional findings are not evidence. What's important in these cases is what's the evidence that supports those findings, just like we do with trial courts and juries and appeals. Nobody has had a chance to examine what the heck is behind those legislative findings. They were simply drafted by Senator Stevens' staff and thrown into the hopper. No hearings, no investigation, no reports, no testimony. We're entitled to investigate what's going on here when the impact is so serious. We don't want the court to draw the line. If this legislation overstepped the bounds, what we're asking is send it back to Congress. Tell them if they want to do this, do it the right way. Do it the proper way. Let's get on with it.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm wrong about a number of things. I was wrong about the amount of time it would take to argue. And who knows what else I might be wrong about as well. Thank you very much for a useful argument on both sides. Evergreen International Airlines versus United States is now submitted for decision. The next case on the argument calendar is Merrill Lynch and Harper versus Harper Family Trust.